Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are one of more than two dozen lodges independently devoted to the cause of theosophy, which is divine wisdom and knowledge and power when properly applied. So we study what are really ancient ideas, but they are also very modern at the same time. Science keeps testing and checking and verifying the ideas put forth in the latter part of the 19th century, which we have been studying now for 130 some years. And it's like an ocean. It's very deep, but at its shore, it won't overwhelm the understanding of a child. So we have no dues or fees. We're an association of students, like-minded students. We do take contributions, but that's done at the book table after the meeting, if you should desire to support this worthy cause. So we welcome all, regardless. That's probably the best way to say it. We welcome you regardless. Come as you are. Come as you, it's just, we don't discriminate against anybody. We welcome all. We're one large brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity here, trying to grasp these ideas which were suppressed for so long, but now are welcome and open to the public. So in order to do this, we have activities. We have two weekly meetings. Naturally, we have one on Sunday morning from 11 to 12. And during the month of November, the umbrella topic is general theosophical principles. Last week, we had a lecture on one life, one self, one source. And today, we are having a panel, two speakers, two short talks on karma. Is it nemesis or is it merciful? Doors open at 10:30 on Sundays, and all are welcome to come and be seated or chat a little bit. And we ask about 5 minutes before the meeting starts to come in and just settle down and just chill. Then on Wednesday evenings, we are studying In the Ocean of Theosophy by William Hugh Judge. We're on, we still on chapter three?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're on chapter three, which is rounds and races. Very, very deep, but also practical. At first glance, it takes some study to apply. But that's the whole idea of the United Lodge of Theosophists. It's applied theosophy. It's theosophy in action. It's philosophy, we meant to say. Applied philosophy in action. So, the library is open from 5:30 to 7:30 on Wednesday evenings. And that there is always a librarian there for any kind of questions you may have. And any direction you may have if you're doing independent study. The part for the evening can be read in the chapter in the Ocean of Theosophy, along with a reference, which it will give you deeper understanding and help you to be better prepared for class. It's a good, if you have the time. Of course, you can do this on your own, you can do it at home, you can do it online. We have a lot of options nowadays. But the library is a nice place to have here. And we have a lot of different books. So without further ado, we will start today's panel. And it is on karma. And the first portion is on Nemesis, and then after the speaker speaks on Nemesis, we will go into, is it merciful? And after them, we will have questions and discussion.
As was said, we are students of a philosophy, which means to put the ideas into action. And one of the first things that newcomers are attracted to is that universal law of karma. And usually they jump into studying and reading all that they can about it. Well, we'll just give you a few of the quotes that you would come across. It is an abstract, impersonal law whose nature, being absolute harmony, is thrown into confusion by discord, suffering, and sin. It is the unerring law which adjusts effect to cause on the physical, mental, and spiritual planes of being. Now, for the individual, we will read, struggle is needed for the gaining of strength. Buffeting adverse errors is for the gaining of depth. Meager opportunities may be used for acquiring fortitude. Poverty should breed generosity. And unless we experience the effects of a certain state of life, we cannot understand or appreciate it from a mere description. Now let someone read in this vein long enough without any other questioning or perhaps discussing it with an older student. They then come to the conclusion that the Greeks had it perfectly. Karma is nemesis. And the Greek word for nemesis means to give what is due. Nemesis is the avenger. Actually, she is implacable justice. And along with her definition, we never realized this before, how cruel she is. Nemesis directs human affairs in such a manner as to restore the right proportions or equilibrium where it has been disturbed. That is a perfect description of karma. However, it is said that if you are blessed with too much fortune or too much good luck or too much promising future, nemesis will visit you to bring losses and suffering in order that you may become humble. You have to feel that there are things that you cannot have. That is part of the definition of nemesis. Now, if we look in other cultures, we'll find that there are the fates and the norns, and they're very specific tasks that have to do with from the moment of birth unto death. But nemesis is the one most often associated with karma. In its own way, it is used by HPB as a description of karma. But she says in the key that we can't just have it stand alone. To connect karma, you have to do it in the triple character of nemesis, adrastia, and themis. We're probably not saying that correctly.
We looked it up, and I think you are saying it correct.
I looked it up and couldn't find it.
Okay.
It was a nemesis. Themis is the goddess of universal order and harmony, who, like Nemesis, is supposed to repress every excess and keep man within the limits of nature. So you have Nemesis, who is the avenger, who will fix it, and who is often depicted with wings to show the fact that you can't get away from her. She is going to follow you, she is going to find you, and you are going to pay. Whereas Themis is order and harmony. Adrastia is the inevitable. In other words, the immutable effect of causes. But HPB goes on to say, Nemesis is without attributes, while the dreaded goddess is absolute and immutable as a principle. We'll repeat that. While the dreaded goddess, Nemesis, is absolute and immutable as a principle, it is we ourselves, nations, and individuals who propel her to action. In other words, Nemesis wouldn't have anything to do if we didn't do wrong things. We propel Nemesis in its direction. And she ends her article called Karma Nemesis with this. Karma Nemesis is the creator of nations and mortals. But once created, it is they who make of her either a fury or a rewarding angel. Yea, wise are they who worship Nemesis.
Wise are they who worship Nemesis. Well, it sounds like a lot of fire and brimstone to me that we got in our sermons, some of us, that were fortunate or unfortunate enough to be raised in certain dogmatic religions, which will remain nameless. But is it really all that bad? I mean, is life like wearing a hair shirt or a... We say no. We say it's merciful. It's merciful because it separates the wheat from the chaff. Nemesis operates against those who are too high or too low. And theosophy, as Buddhism, promulgates that middle ground, seeking that middle ground, seeking that balance. And one of the things that makes karma merciful, well, it's pleasing to, it is merciful not because it's pleasing to the personality, because the personality is, in a sense, like a runaway train without an engineer. And it wants to go after the sensations and the feelings and the temporal pleasures. But it is pleasing, it is merciful, and it is pleasing to the higher ego, Ishwara, the Lord, which is the observer. So as the observer, the personality needs, well, the observer is observing, but the personality needs training, it needs discipline, it needs that, it needs strictness in order to build fortitude, mercy, justice, and generosity. Because fortitude, mercy, justice, and generosity, although justice and generosity are definitely found in children, young children, if they're not too spoiled, they're naturally generous, we think. I mean, up to a certain stage, it's me, me, me. But by the age of two, especially three, most children, they're willing to share with you. They want some give and some take. But fortitude and mercy are other qualities that are developed by Nemesis. Nemesis is actually our friend, and it helps us to be merciful, just as suffering helps us to become more understanding. Suffering is it's a phase, it's a critical state, as it were. But once that critical state is passed, if we don't rush right back, if we're mind beings, if we're really thinking as mind beings, which which is our true self, that principle of manas, then we can distill the lessons that we've learned. So we're seeking the middle ground, and disadvantages for many do bring them down and distract them and lead them off onto other paths. But as was mentioned in the talk earlier, that hardship is not necessarily a bad thing. And for those intrepid souls who are consciously incarnating into those difficult circumstances, they can be a beacon for all that surround them. These intrepid souls are looking for opportunities to build up character, and they are good and merciful souls. So over the course of many lives we've lived, we must go through all experiences, and we learn little from pleasurable times. They are a rest and not a final destination. It's something to be transcended. It's good to enjoy the good times, as long as, well, Nemesis will get you if you're enjoying it a little too much. Nemesis will get you, that is for sure. So what is needed in theosophy is emulation and not rivalry. If we emulate those great souls, those great teachers, and we read about their lives, well, we read about their hardships, their trials, their tribulations, and we want to emulate them. None of the great teachers stressed rivalry or cutthroat competition. It was all what is the greater good for all concerned. We all want to gratify our senses, of course, as we already said, but that does not help the higher self or help us to become closer and one with the higher self. So there's a lot more here, but these talks are meant to be brief talks so that we can have conversation, a dialogue, and at this time we will open up for discussion on karma. Is it nemesis or is it merciful, or is it both? In the back.
What is meant when someone says that they're someone's karma nemesis? Can a person be a karma nemesis to another?
Yes, but if, and let's make this very clear, if that is your intention, you are creating a horrible karma for yourself. However, we can, just by the way we look or sound or a simple word we say to someone, have a profound, I don't know the adjective for nemesis, but have a profound effect on that person. Do you remember in grade school, somebody might have said something to you once and you've never forgotten it? It really hurt your feelings or made you feel apart? Somebody can be that for you without intending to. So it's your karma.
Yes, it is your karma, as all karma is. All karma has our name on it. It's delivered. It's signed, sealed, and delivered. We always get exactly what we deserve in order to learn the lesson that we need to learn at the time, because there are appropriate vehicles, and there are actually many vehicles. But if we just take three, that we are spirit, soul, and matter. We are physical, spiritual,
mental,
we meant to say, yes. So we have the mental, the spiritual and the physical. And then there's various planes. And some people go through tremendous trials with their physical karma. They're the ones that we see, we know they're suffering. But we often don't know that people are suffering, like the dark night of the soul is an expression where they're really, really searching for meaning in life. So there's many planes, and they usually, it can work out on all planes at once. It can work out on various planes. But the key is there needs to be an appropriate vehicle, because we never get more than we can handle. Even though that doesn't seem true sometimes, that theosophy would say it is true that we have the appropriate vehicle. We may not want it. We may not want to deal with it right now. We may do everything we can to just find pleasure and escape, but we should be facing whatever's coming to us, because it's really got our name written on it.
In the back.
And we wondered, too, in regards to the contribution about can a person be karma nemesis, and we wonder, like in families, the way some siblings are to each other, and you wonder then, because they're obviously working out some kind of issues together, so we think each one can help the other. And the idea that nemesis and merciful can occur at the same time, we think that that could happen if each one is a nemesis for the other. There's a lot of lessons that could be learned there.
If. There's a huge if over that. There are siblings that fought together all their childhood and now don't speak as adults. So it does take that sense of wanting to cooperate and understand. We often think merciful, as an example to people, is sometimes twisted. As the parent of a handicapped child, I often went through this. You're out with your child, stumbles, falls, the leg brace is so stiff that they cannot easily get up. And you stand there and wait while they struggle to get up. And strangers will come up and hiss at you. What are you, a monster? And they'll try to help the child. We finally learned you have to say, oh, are you going to go with him to school? It isn't merciful to step in. It isn't merciful always to change things or to help. You have to know the circumstances, and you have to know, to the best of your ability, what the soul needs. It's a complicated question.
Indeed, yes.
It was mentioned a few times in the presentation that karma as nemesis brings down the high and the mighty, so to speak, or if we have too much. But to what degree does motive play in that? What about if our motive is to become as great and to acquire as many things as we can in order to help others? Will karma be our nemesis then?
Well, we'd like to start, though, with Mr. Crosby's question. So you would like to do this, to acquire all of this in order to help humanity. What do you do with what you have now? How do you use your money now? How do you use your time now? So your motive could be exalted, but it's twisted because you're not applying what you have at the moment to that same purpose. The fact is, karma nemesis is after the one who is proud and haughty, not the one who seeks to get blessings that they can share them. If that were true, then every breadwinner in a family, male or female, would be making a serious mistake, because they're making it for the good of the family.
So, yes, nemesis will get us back on the path. If we let it, if we distill the lessons, we need to distill the lessons. Maybe there's another term for someone who's taken a vow and is on a path, and like the Buddha did, and really wants the most, wants to be tested. And we think that Nemesis, if one starts to stray from that path, that Nemesis could come into play. But we wonder if there's another term or a better way of describing that.
We're thinking that anybody who really wants to learn something will invite their instructor or the teacher to criticize them, mm-hmm. to test them, to even whip them in the shade. Is the term. So we might think of karma almost as a coach.
Coach,
or we have a term parenting, but it's not personal in that way. But it's that universal adjuster.
But if we realize that, we cannot ever complain when our difficulties get bigger, because it means the coach is listening, and you're now being asked to lift more than you did before.
Thank you. Yes.
One thing that confuses me about karma, well, first of all, I want so much to believe in karma, but I get caught up because you can't believe in karma and not believe in reincarnation, and I'm not there yet, number one. But number two, karma, to me it makes sense that everything is a circle. Everything that you put out into the universe eventually will come back to you. Where I get confused is that if you put out something that's, let's say, quote, good, well then that should come back as good. But in the world of polarity, isn't it that when you create something good, by definition you are creating its opposite simultaneously?
Oh, you've been busy thinking a lot.
Well, but, you know, so in that way, well, I think you get what I'm saying.
Yes, absolutely.
So maybe you can comment on that.
Well, karma is, let's leave the word for a moment and say cause and effect. Cause and effect clearly rules on the physical plane. We will all agree on that. You can't have an effect without a cause. You can't have a cause without creating an effect. The difference is that this takes in the mental and moral nature. In other words, for a human, it's why I do something and not just the something. You say when you do something good, you certainly create the possibility for the equal amount of force to be used in a negative way. You're not creating the negative force. Just as if I push a door, a swinging door, I create the possibility that it could swing back because it's a natural reaction. But if I stop that door, it doesn't happen. If you act from the good will return, but you may not recognize it. How do you know what is good for you? You don't really. Sometimes people come to realize the worst things that happened to them were the best things because it made them review, rethink, sort of reprogram their entire lives. Was there a second part to that?
Well, we were just thinking that karma is an effect, an effect-producing cause. So once there's action, it literally means action. It's an effect-producing cause. It ceaselessly works to restore equilibrium. If you don't believe in reincarnation, you can still believe in karma, but it's a limited, it limits the scope of it because there's only so much you can do in one life. And if you've lived...
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
How can you, quote, believe in karma and not know and not accept reincarnation? Because you're saying, oh, okay, for every cause there is an effect, except when I die. Then all those effects, all those causes I set up are meaningless. So we don't think you can straddle it that way. We think it's either if cause and effect is the universal law, then obviously I have to return in order to get the results of the causes I set up.
Well, we generally go from universals to particulars. So the universal way to look at things is to look at karma and reincarnation as twin doctrines. But if we're not ready for that, we can look at particulars in our own life and see where sometimes we can get the results quickly. Physical karma, if we put our hand in the fire, or if we go into the ocean after the lifeguards are telling us not to, we can be either burned or pulled out to sea. So we can see some of its operations. No, it's ultimately, it's a baby step in a sense, or a, maybe I shouldn't have used that term baby step, but it's we can incrementally go from particulars to universals and then back to particulars if we desire, but we stress, theosophy stresses really examining the universals first and then to test, check, and verify to see if those particulars hold true.
We just like to add one thing, and we think it really helps when you're considering these ideas. You look at your sense of self, I. Nothing has ever changed it. Consider, if you can, how young was I when I first realized I was I? Some little kids do it at 2, some at 3, some at 4. Who told you? Seriously, who told you you are I? And how is it that that I that you know you are has never altered? From the time that you realized it, how many physical changes have you been through? You died as a toddler, in a sense, to become a young adolescent and then a young adult, and then you get older. You keep going through these physical huge alterations. And then there's the mental ones. Are you the same capacity of thinker as when you were 5, as when you were 15, as when you were 30? No. Well, where are all those changes? I still remain. All those things have changed. Then when we look at the emotional and everything else, we realize I am the only most meaningful thing about me. I endure. Everything about me changes. I cannot be destroyed by the change in the physical substance. Therefore, what could death possibly do? I endure.
In the back, please.
So, looking at the universal from the previous speaker, if the universe is balanced, harmony. As we act, we throw it slightly out of balance. Mercy, or universal justice, returns it to balance by returning to us what we have set forward. So it's a constant give and take. The polarity that was spoken of will be restored as we work through the effect of that cause we set into motion. But as was said, there may not be time in this lifetime or conditions in this lifetime for that to return. So isn't nemesis and mercy the perfect definition of divine justice? It has to be both.
Mm-hmm. Nemesis and mercy is divine justice. Yeah, and we have in our Constitution, we have prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishments. And karma are not cruel and unusual punishments. It can seem cruel in its operation. It actually can seem unusual, too. Mm-hmm. But it's not. And it's just like our Constitution is, if it's being enforced properly, which it should be, usually is. But, you know, we're working here on the mundane level. But we have a correspondence in our Constitution with higher principles.
We would like to mention a balance beam. Not the balance beam for gymnastics. It's on a center post, and you stand on it and try to bring your feet closer and closer together without flying through the air. It's very hard to do. But if we would remember, we are that in the center, which doesn't change, and karma, merciful, nemesis. That's the labels that we put on the things that we weigh and consider and judge. It is the thing that was merciful to me yesterday may seem a nemesis to someone else. So it's all on how we value it, and we always stand changeless in the center if we could just identify with that once.
Yeah.
Yes?
Well, then, could we not have a feeling of I am karma?
Mm.
I make the causes. I'm going to reap the effects. Is that possible?
No, that's it. It does. The philosophy does say that.
Well,
we are karma.
Karma is law, and law is an aspect of deity. We have the three fundamental propositions. We have one principle. We have two other aspects of it. Yes, this gentleman there.
It's our understanding that we start from unity. The word equilibrium was mentioned. We use the term the universal law. However, we find ourselves as saying, your karma, my karma. Is that a reasonable expression?
Yes, if I have a toothache.
View of unity?
But as a unity, we all share what is happening in this city, in this country, on this earth. That is absolutely true. But individually, we experience things. Now, it's what we do with that experience. If we become greedy and selfish because of the things that happen in our lives, or we seek to expand our wisdom, expand our compassion, there is family karma. There is national karma. We have to realize, as an individual, we are part of all of that. You know, it's funny. We just had an election at which not that many people voted again. And we don't recall the percentage, but it wasn't overwhelming. Well, what is the karma of that kind of national behavior? One would assume you'll find yourself in a life someday where you don't have the opportunity to vote, because you have said to life, I don't care. I don't care about that. So you get national karma through the behavior of individuals.
Yeah. There are so many kinds of karma. And, of course, we're talking about the mercy and the nemesis factors today. But we can go off on, we can go anywhere with karma, because it does encompass all, and it encompasses all action in the universe that we're connected with, and we're not connected with other universes, really. I mean, we're to be concerned with this universe. Yeah, is this a follow-up?
Well, it's so very easy to make our judgments based on our degree of understanding of the universe. And as a consequence, we often hear, my karma, your karma is not my karma. And we isolate ourselves from opportunities to help others adjust. Doesn't mean we interfere, but we see others suffer and we don't separate ourselves from that by labeling it from a personal point of view. Harmony in this plane is justice in the spiritual plane, and justice in the spiritual plane is harmony. So the use of the balance, called an analytical balance, most of all, it's a very sharp edge that those different plans function. We are neither the fans, we in fact are that point. And this gives us a sharing in the karma of others.
But of course we can't force harmony on anyone else, no matter how we feel or what we might like. We all know that within a family, that there will be stresses and strains, and The best of intentions, you can't do anything about it but endure it and try to stay as calm and quiet as you can. So my karma, your karma, there's only karma. There's only law.
Yeah, I just briefly. Do we have it? It's out on the book.
Okay,
good. This is just a wonderful
compilation.
Thank you. Compilation of karma by William Q. Judge, but especially the aphorisms, because aphorisms are so, they're so pithy, and you can really carry these with you, and you can think about it for a day, a week, a month, just one of them, and really watch its operation unfold. But so we just wanted to mention that. Now, there's been a hand all the way in the back there. Yes. Yes.
Okay. My question has to do with great sorrow and pain and suffering. Now, if an individual is able to go through that kind of situation, learn the lessons as far as he's concerned, develop compassion and understanding and so forth, strive to develop those virtues. When the tide changes and one might speak of great wealth and all of that, is it not possible that if he understood the sorrow and pain, the self stands between the two, why not understand great wealth?
Well, there are those that they can use their wealth for good that have... one thing that Mr. Judge says is never to judge the karma of another, is that only an adept can do that. So we can posit ideas, we can discuss it certainly, because it is a possibility that those with great wealth can use it wisely. Why not? I mean, if they don't get carried away with the lower mind, and if they really know how to help others, and there are.
We often hear the expression that one who has too much I don't know how to get too much without karma, but at any rate, one who gets great wealth, if he doesn't know what to do with it, he can fall down back to poverty. But it would seem to me that the wisdom that enables one to overcome great sorrow is not lost when great wealth comes, because truth is, he's neither of the two.
Well, I don't, we don't know if we can make a statement as to that the truth that we think it would depend on the individual.
Yes.
It's a possibility.
Yes.
It is a possibility for sure.
Well, we're told to be trustees of what we have, that we should take care of what we have, appreciate what we have, but let go of it when it's taken from us, because that is its natural result.
Okay.
That's
a
trustee.
It would seem to us, get through great karma, we have to let loose of attachments.
Mm-hmm.
Karma doesn't make us bad. Wealth doesn't make us good.
That's
it's
true.
Only experiences through which the soul goes.
Right.
So why get carried away over either?
Exactly.
The middle path.
As you said.
The middle path, for sure. Do you want to pick somebody?
Steve's back. Oh, Steve said his hand.
Yes, yes.
Just to bring up the previous question, a parent struggled with in saying that would like very much to believe in karma, but is not yet ready to believe in reincarnation, or hasn't reached that point. It sounds as if the individual thinks that the fact of karma depends on reincarnation first, when in fact it's the other way around.
Yeah, that's true. That's
karma
true.
Is the law. There can be no re-embodiment, which is not the re-expression or the effect of the same thing that existed before in another manifestation. So they may be two different doctrines that we think we have to believe, but it's one reality, one law looked at from different points of view.
Yes, because reincarnation is the method karma uses in order for you to get the effect of a cause you set up. You know, many people think karma is linear. You know, I hit you and then you're going to hit me, either in this life or the next life. But it isn't. It's more formulaic. You have acted in certain ways. You have a limited instrument in this life, brain, body, health, circumstances, wealth, for receiving the results of things you have done in other lives. You may have a change in this life, and you will read about them. We just had several of them. People who are leading very powerful, important lives, and overnight it is all taken away. So it is the method. Reincarnation is the method of karma. Yes.
For me, again, I really want to believe in karma, but there's also what's been mentioned by you and some other people is that there's this I am, which is immutable, which you cannot change. So why not just go below the surface, be the I am, and watch all this drama happen? And it doesn't affect you. Just
well,
allow
why not?
It to be. It doesn't matter.
Why not?
Care? Why put relevance? Why worry about it? Find that place of I am and just be and watch the drama unfold. And who cares about what's the cause of this and that and all that?
Question. What do you think that I am wants?
To be.
Or needs? To be. To be what?
Just to be. Not to be anything, but just
but it
be.
Already is, and nothing can alter that. We're told that at the end of the digestion or the assimilation from Devakan, where we have assimilated all of the best of our hopes and dreams from this last life, that at the end we come forward as that spiritual consciousness, that just pure I, and we see what is to come, the natural result in a broad outline of what we have created, and we accept it with joy and with eagerness, because that I knows it is one with every other I. And there are those that are starving and suffering and needing. So we go forward back into incarnation, lose the vision, maybe carry it as a glimmer or a memory, or as it was put once, as an aroma. But we lose that because if we knew at all times, I am and nothing can affect that, we would do exactly what you said. Which is, who cares about anything?
Right. If we were just I am and not caring about anything else, then there would be no evolution. There's the drama is evolution. The play, if the actors acting on the stage, is the evolutionary process. And the universe exists for the evolution of soul, not just our own soul, but for all soul, for the souls of rocks and minerals and... You know, they have latent, they have all the same principles as we have, but they're latent. They haven't been thrilled. The thrill of activity, and it's the thrill of the spirit cycling through it, it's, in a sense, trapped in its current state, as we are trapped in our current state, because the human state is not the be-all and end-all. It's a stage.
But what I'm saying is that you could find beauty in the nemesis just as easily by watching
sure.
it.
Sure.
So it, just if you have, if you're grounded in that I am, then you can find just as much beauty in the negative as the positive. So, you know, I think it's, for me, I want to be grounded in the I am and just watch the drama unfold and watch the evolution unfold and recognize that that's not me, you know? And still,
but,
you know,
well, but... But we are here. We are in conditioned existence. We are in bodies. We have to deal with it. We have to be involved. That I am is an observer. It can't act. It can only observe. There's no action there. In the back?
So the speaker a few moments ago was describing a life's journey of suffering and pain and working through those circumstances to get to the point where better understanding was reached. And we think Theosophy would say none of that work. It says nothing is ever lost. Where compared with the life where we are just observing and not involving to learn those lessons, you know, the one who sees as the I am is the adept, who has gone through every stage of suffering and pain and existence that we're working through to understand it is all one, but we have to go through the work to get there.
But then tell the Buddha he wasted his time. He should have just been sitting there going, I am the I am, and I can just look at everything. Right. None of it matters.
He had that choice.
And
he had that choice, but he decided to renounce that.
Compassion is, we are told,
the
bowels of life. We have no choice but to reach towards it. If we don't, we keep learning the lessons we have to learn until we experience enough and know what the other is going through. We can't just be observing that spiritual identity that is behind us as a thinker is the observer and the perceiver. But while here, we have to act. We have to use that.
We think, too, that when we say we are the observer, we're told that in philosophy as something to posit, something to think about, that we're more than just these bodies. But when we say we are the observer, we're not in touch with that. We as bodies and minds and souls at this stage in our development, it's just something to think about that that's what we really are. But we are not in touch with that.
What about meditation?
Well, well, it's higher states.
Yes.
But we're talking about the daily living.
But they're open to all of us, though.
Yes.
The higher states. Yes.
Well, there's nothing contradictory about trying to be the observer.
Right.
And observe the changing aspects of life while engaged in it. It's meditation in action. But what the reason we have to pay attention to the relative cause and effect, it's the operation of karma in our life as nemesis that prevents us from reaching that high state. And until we understand the obstacles we're setting up and why, we will not be able to maintain it.
We don't recall who it was, but there's a story of a struggling disciple who goes through all kinds of difficulties. And when he reaches, like we use the Greek one, Mount Olympus, everyone, all the gods and goddesses are watching respectfully, knowing that he's going to go to Zeus and say, thank you for the power you gave me. Instead, he goes to Nemesis, throws himself at her feet and says, without you, I could never have done it. In other words, if I am not challenged in my thinking and my behavior, I just become more of what I already am, and that's getting me nowhere. So the fact is, those experiences that we don't want to have are going to be the ones that cause us to reflect and finally come to realize, I have to change. I can't keep doing this. What is that expression? Neuroses is expecting the same result from the same act.
That's insanity.
Insanity. I must be insane. Goodness. Doing the same thing and expecting a different result. That's what it is. The fact is that life is law and just. And if we would trust that, just for a week or a month, and just act as though that is true. What I do comes back to me sooner or later in different ways. We will find that we don't have to trust that. It is the very core of our being behind you. Yes,
in the corner.
Yes.
There is really really no way we can live life as an observer, saying, I am, and life happens around me, because all our lives are interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
We just, even in meditation, we are not separate. Life is one unified whole, mm-hmm. and we are all part of it. And an observer would be outside.
Right, but we can begin to observe ourselves in action. I mean, we are told to do that nightly, that at the end of the day we take a quiet moment and review, not to criticize ourselves, but to observe and realize we could have done this differently, we could have done that better. And it is becoming the observer, but not to be indifferent and inactive, but to know what you're doing and why. It is the why that is so important.
Why?
See, we shut them all up.
Right. Go ahead.
In the second presentation, the idea was that karma, nemesis, teaches us to be merciful and generous and strong and enduring. Without that experience, we could not develop those things.
Right.
But are not those virtues from our higher nature? It almost sounds that in order to have them, we need external things enforced on us. Aren't they already there and just need to come through?
Hmm.
Of course. But what makes them come through? The experience.
It's the experience. It's like the athlete training. Karma nemesis. Nemesis is like the trainer, the coach, as was mentioned earlier, who's pushing. He knows how far to push and how hard to push without killing, without killing the person or driving them totally bonkers. But so that's what it's like. It pushes us to do what's right, what's just, what's merciful. If we're ethical people, and ethics are learned in home and school and in society, and if we're unethical, even unethical people, unless they're completely depraved or sociopaths, have an idea of what the right behavior is, and they like it from others and expect it from others. And sometimes reciprocate. So,
but here goes mercy again. It is said that even someone like that doesn't lose the glimmer of hope and will face karmas that hopefully will reawaken so that they will go back to an ethical way of life. Yes?
Well, there's a saying that's almost trite from overuse but still profound. Walk a mile in my shoes. There are certain situations under which we cannot judge how we are treating others because we have no idea of how it's being registered. Most of the misogynists today really think that they're working on behalf of women. When they want to pass laws or do things to restrict and put women in a lesser position. They cannot understand power of what they do until they experience it, and they can't experience it in this life as a man.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have that experience as a woman to see what those influences that they have exerted become in another person's life.
An interesting study of karma is to look around and see what impacts you. If something impacts you greatly, you might have been part of what created it. In other words, women who are very, very constrained may have been some of the men that created the problem. So,
well, we really need to end right here because we do keep cycles. The doctrine of cycles, we meet from 11 to 12, and it's been, we could go on much longer, but it's been, we hope that you have found this meeting to be educational, and we're elucidating or stimulating, and we hope that you return. Thank you.